This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, a Sin City showdown as Democrats debate in Las Vegas and Hillary Clinton takes on the all-boys club.
I'm not playing, as some people say, the gender card. Here in Las Vegas, I'm just trying to play the winning card.
Pakistani opposition leader Benazir Bhutto rejects the interim cabinet and turns up the heat on President Musharraf.
We need to see whether we can come up with an interim government of national consensus to whom power can be handed.
Barry Bonds is indicted for perjury and obstruction of justice in the steroid scandal. Here's what the home run king said after passing Hank Aaron in August.
This record is not tainted at all. At all. Period. And you guys can say whatever you want.
This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes inside the headlines and more. We have a great crew with us this week in Chicago. Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial page writer at the Chicago Tribune. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks.
In Chicago, Rick Perlstein, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, a think tank and advocacy center focusing on kitchen table economics. He writes the blog called The Big Con. He's the author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and The Unmaking of the American Consensus. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Bob.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, always good to have you.
Hello, Bob, Steve, and Rick.
Hi, Jack.
Hi.
Let me ask you, first of all, what's the big story for this week for all three of you? And Rick, let's start with you.
Well, my big story is one that actually probably you haven't read about in your papers. It's that the Republican Congress, the Republican minority, is about to file their 54th filibuster petition, which is the record for in only halfway through the Congress, they've filibustered as much legislation as any previous Congress did in 2 years. So they're basically not letting any Democratic legislation going through and basically institutionalizing the idea that you need 60 votes in order to pass a piece of legislation.
Steve?
I think the big story this week is Pakistan, and it's one of the most dangerous places on the planet, and we have a role to play, and we don't really know what role that's going to be.
Jack Beatty.
Well, to me, the biggest news was last night when a question asked by Christopher Jackson, a three-tour Marine veteran from Iraq, who asked, "I feel that if we continue on the path we're at, that we're going to end up in Iran." And his mother went on to say, "What will you candidates do to stop the neocons from taking us into another war?" And Hillary Clinton, who voted for the amendment Kyle Lieberman amendment that in effect helped to put us on that road to war, in her response Christopher, she said that Iranian weapons were killing American soldiers. First of all, that has never been proved. The effort in February of last year to prove it, to show charges and mortar rounds and so on, was equivocal at best, according to McClatchy newspapers. Secondly, just this week and also last week, U.S. officials, military officials in Iraq have said that we believe that the Iranians are keeping the initiatives and commitments they made about stopping supplying weapons to the enemy here. And the militaries had, that was a military briefer. And the significance of this is in short, war with Iran will be on the ballot in November if Rudy Giuliani is the nominee for the Republican Party. And if Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, What will they argue about? I mean, you know, this is highly significant that she is saying things even stronger now than the Bush administration, it seems, about the connection between the death of American soldiers and Iranian weapons.
Let's talk more about the presidential debate in Nevada last night. With only 7 weeks to go before the voting starts with the Iowa caucuses, can we expect more of what happened last night, the boys' club ganging up on Hillary Clinton? And here's some of it. Senator Barack Obama began last night by continuing with a more aggressive strategy he adopted in the last debate, attacking Senator Clinton.
Senator Clinton, I think, is a capable politician, and I think that she has run a terrific campaign. But what the American people are looking for right now is straight answers to tough questions. And that is not what we've seen out of Senator Clinton on a host of issues, on the issue of driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. We saw in the last debate that it took not just that debate, but 2 more weeks before we could get a clear answer in terms of where her position was. The same is true on Social Security.
Senator John Edwards joined in the Clinton criticism, continuing his role as one of her harshest critics in the debates.
She says she will turn up the heat on George Bush and the Republicans. But when the crucial vote came on stopping Bush, Cheney, and the neocons on Iran, she voted with Bush and Cheney. On the issue of Social Security, she said standing beside me on the stage that she would not do anything about the cap on Social Security taxes. And she has said privately to people, because it's been reported in the press, that in fact she would consider raising that cap. And the most important issue is she says she will bring change to Washington while she continues to defend a system that does not work, that is broken, that is rigged, and is corrupt.
Last night, unlike the previous debate, Senator Clinton seemed ready to fire back here in response to John Edwards.
I don't mind taking hits on my record, on issues, but when somebody starts throwing mud, at least we can hope that it's both accurate and not right out of the Republican playbook. Because what I believe is important is that we put forth what we stand for. I have been active for 35 years. The American people know where I stand. You know, Senator Edwards raised health care again. When Senator Edwards ran in 2004, he wasn't for universal health care.
I'm wondering if the three of you think that Senator Clinton came out ahead last night simply stating what instinctively most voters probably already think they know when she said, they're coming after me because I'm ahead. Steve Chapman.
I thought she did better than she did in the last debate, but I didn't think she did as well as a lot of the commentators said afterward. I don't think she plays defense very well. I think she comes across looking defensive, and I thought she kind of overstepped when she said, Edwards was guilty of mudslinging. I didn't hear him doing anything that sounded like mudslinging. I heard him criticizing positions she's taken or refused to take. It was all, perfectly legitimate issues to raise. And I thought that struck me as kind of a typical of her defensive style. And I just didn't think she came across terribly well. I thought, you know, you had to give her points for being ready and being willing to state some of her differences clearly this time.
Rick Perlstein.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Edwards' critiques of her, if you want to say flip-flopping, were actually quite sharp and careful and calm and well-reasoned. He said, for example, that she's called for a timeout on new trade deals, but you know she's supporting this extension of NAFTA into Peru. I was actually struck on the issue of trade that when someone asked about NAFTA, and Wolf Blitzer made a crack about was Ross Perot right? She just kind of laughed and dismissed it and said, I don't remember any of that stuff. I mean, she did kind of did this kind of blushing schoolgirl. I just remember these charts. This is serious business. I mean, we can argue about whether trade deals are the way to go or not. But, you know, NAFTA has probably led to about the loss of 1 million jobs. And that's one of the big issues that the Democrats who won the Congress in 2006 ran on. So if she's just going to retreat on that or flip-flop on it, that's not going to help her.
Jack Beatty, Senator Dodd said last night he worried about the shrillness of the debate. Is there a danger in that for Democrats? Are they at risk of turning off voters?
Well, you hear that, and you hear that especially about Iowa voters who are famously for good government, and they like a clean debate, and they want to get to the issues. But the fact is that unless you raise differences, it's simply going to be a coronation. She's simply going to win the everything. And that's what had happened really through most of this year. I mean, they weren't raising any substantive issues, either issue position differences with her or differences about her financing and about, you know, talking about, as John Edwards was, talking about what good will it do to substitute corporate Democrats for corporate Republicans.
There's somewhat of a risk in declaring yourself the front runner. And all along, the Clinton campaign has tried to project this air of inevitability. Isn't there risk that ornery, independent-feeling voters in Iowa, in New Hampshire, you know, hate to feel like they're being told how they're going to vote, so they close the curtain behind them on primary or caucus day, grab the voter pencil on the ballot and say, oh, yeah, take that, front runner.
Well, you know, there's a lot of evidence for that. I mean, Steve Chapman, in an earlier column earlier this year, he pointed out that at this point in 1975, Jimmy Carter was, what, 5% in the polls?
3%.
3% in the polls, and he went on to win in Iowa.
About Eben Muskie in my book. He was the big front runner in 1972. He didn't do too well.
That's right.
Bill Clinton was sixth out of sixth at this stage in 92.
Howard Dean?
Yeah, we all
there we go. He was way up.
Ask President Dean about being a front runner.
Right. And John Kerry was mortgaging his house.
On the other hand, last night when I can't remember which of the candidates was criticizing Clinton, the audience started booing. Is that a reflection of
like it was? It looked to me like it was a pretty heavily Clinton crowd, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's representative of Democrats in general. I mean, you look at the Iowa poll that came out yesterday, and she and Edwards and Obama are all running about even. And I think where people are paying attention, she's not necessarily the front runner.
Talking about this week in the news. What do you make of all the finger pointing in the California oil spill? Was Governor Spitzer right to back down on giving illegal immigrants a driver's license or not? We're speaking this hour with Rick Perlstein, historian and author of Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater, and The Unmaking of the American Consensus. Also with Steve Chapman, columnist at the Chicago Tribune, and with our own Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Back to the presidential debate in Las Vegas last night for just another couple of minutes. In the middle of all the back and forth debate between Senator Clinton, Senator Obama, former Senator Edwards, was New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson trying to cut through, trying to distinguish himself from the top tier candidates, but he did get a few shots in.
You know, it seems that John wants to start a class war. It seems that Barack wants to start a generational war. It seems that Senator Clinton, with all due respect on her plan on Iraq, doesn't end the war. All I want to do is give peace a chance.
Bill Richardson last night at the debate, the Democratic presidential debate in Las Vegas. What's your take on it? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Ed is on the line from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. I've now watched four of the Democratic debates, and in each one, Joe Biden seems to be the guy that distinguishes himself among this field. And, you know, I know that, you know, part of the media's job is to report the position of the front runners and kind of the tit for tat that goes on between front runners. But, you know, I guess I'd be interested in getting your panelists' opinion about whether or not Joe Biden could pull off a Jimmy Carter type performance in 1975 like Steve Chapman or Jack Beatty referred to earlier.
Rick Perlstein, Senator Joe Biden at the back of the pack in the 2008 Democratic presidential race. Can he move up?
Yeah, I think he's going to have a tough time. I mean, primary voters are, of course, the liberal Democratic base. And something about Joe Biden, he's been very bad on these kind of kitchen table economic issues. I mean, he's the guy who sponsored the bankruptcy bill, which was basically a giveaway to the credit card companies. So a lot of people know that, and that, I think, holds him back among the Democratic base.
But you know, he said something last night that I think all the other candidates should commit to. And he said, if Bush launches an attack on Iran without going to Congress for approval, quote, he should be impeached. We need to hear that from these other people so that it'll act as a deterrent on just that eventuality. I think that, that one sentence should recommend him to those liberal voters.
But Jack Beatty, will it? Jack Beatty, will it?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, I listen every morning to Morning Edition on C-SPAN where people call in. And there were, over the course of about 90 minutes, there were about six different calls from Republicans saying how fearful they were that he'd be the nominee and how much they were impressed by it.
Thanks for your call, Ed. Donnie, you're now on the line from Plainfield, Vermont. Hi, Donnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Bob. I want to comment on something that, for me, was quite glaring in the moderation of the debate, and it happened right at the end. One of the people who was invited to ask questions asked a question something along the lines of, how are you going to bring this country together? How are you going to speak to this country in a way that's going to unite this country? And Wolf Blitzer, in my opinion, rightly gave this question to Obama, and he said to Obama, you think Hillary can't do this. Why do you think Hillary can't do it? And it completely turned this woman's question around. She didn't ask that question. She asked each of these individuals to make a statement about what they thought was potential for the future of America. And that's really, I was taken back by it. Would you care to comment?
Let's Steve Chapman take this.
I agree. I mean, I think if you want to have real people ask questions, let the real people ask questions. If you want to have professional journalists do it, then let them do it. But this sort of hybrid we had last night where Suzanne Melveaux or Wolf would take a question from the audience and then add their own question or just replace the original question with their own, I just found that very annoying. I don't know why you're going to bring ordinary voters into this process if you're just going to kind of push them to the side when you don't get quite the question you want.
Yeah, ditto. That's what I was going to say.
Donnie, thanks.
Wolf's presumptions and the assumptions he was using throughout the debate, I thought were really, they were, you might say, implicitly anti-Democrat, against the Democrats. For example, he raised this issue of merit pay for teachers, which of course, first of all, it's a local issue. It has to do with local schools. Secondly, it's a vexed issue because how do you know what teacher is better than the other teacher? What could possibly show that? And it's the kind of killer question the Republicans like, showing the Democrats are enthralled to this hated union that happens to represent all of most American teachers. And he also used the phrase illegals, talking about immigrants, and he was called on that by a couple of people. And when he's talking about Roe v. Wade, he used the words he said abortion. Are you for abortion? Well, it's abortion rights. And again, the concepts he was using were crude and sort of agitprop, I thought, on the conservative side.
Are there too many debates? It seems like there's been a weekly debate since this campaign began 2 years ago. Have we had too many?
I think so. I mean, I think that once you get to the point where they're kind of drifting off the fumes of the previous debates, and they get further and further from the kind of basic fundamental questions, and the debates become about the debates, I'm not sure that's the best way to get the Democratic message out there.
I don't think there are too many debates, because I think there are plenty of people who haven't watched any of them and may tune in one of these. But I would like to see some changes in the format. I'd like to see two or three person debates among the current candidates. I don't think there are too many candidates now, and I think they all need to be included. But I think it would be much more useful to have John Edwards and Bill Richardson going at each other, or Hillary and Dennis Kucinich. I mean, you could have some interesting matchups, and I think they would illuminate some things that this cattle call approach doesn't really.
Donnie, thanks for your call. Let's stay in Iowa and talk to Donna from Story City. Hi, Donna.
Hello, Bob. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm out here working, volunteering for Joe Biden, and it is so frustrating when they have these debates that you've been talking about that Joe has to struggle to get in, it seems like. I believe last night went better than some of the others, But then the coverage the next day, for all you would know, the only people there were Hillary and Obama and sometimes Edwards. Even NPR this morning spent about 5 minutes covering what Hillary said and what kind of a fight Hillary was in. And then they grudgingly went through the list of the other participants at the debate with a one-sentence summary of what they had said. And this, it's very hard for me to see how this gives anyone else in the country an idea of what these people stand for.
Yeah,
we're lucky.
Rick Perlstein, yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, if you go to Chris Dodd's website, who's someone I admire a great deal, he does a debate clock. And he actually times down to the second how many minutes each candidate gets, and it actually bears out your thesis quite well. I think Wolf Blitzer did a terrible job moderating, but also because the candidates were bickering and calling each other out by name so much, and once they call someone out by name, they have to be able to respond. You know, the whole first quarter of the debate was just kind of this rattling together of these three big candidates who were answering each other's charges. It was quite unfair, I thought.
They really don't seem to even make an effort to allocate the time equally. And you sort of feel like they're just kind of putting up with these, you know, so-called second-tier candidates just because they have to. And they really don't have much interest in what they have to say.
Let's talk about the 2008 Republican presidential campaign for a couple of minutes, and a second-tier candidate who may, in fact, be moving up, Governor Huckabee, Mike Huckabee. Is he the GOP candidate to watch as he's popping up or moving up in the polls closer to the top? If this were music ratings, would he be fourth in the charts but with a silver arrow on the way up?
I think his problem is just that, the silver. He's not getting much money, even though he's doing well. He's surging in Iowa, but you know, if he continues this surge, people are going to start to look at his proposals, and he favors a tax that even the Wall Street sort of national sales tax that even the Wall Street Journal op-ed page attacked as just a non-starter, something that effectively would raise taxes for everybody but the richest Americans. And if people start looking at that seriously, and he defends it every time out, that's not going to help him among the it's going to sort of counter his image as I'm the one Republican who talks about people who are laid off or having trouble meeting their commitments. It's hard to say that at the same time favoring a sort of Steve Forbes tax cut.
Yeah, I think as more people look at him, he's going to come off as quite extreme. I mean, the first thing he did as governor was took away funding for a mentally retarded woman who was raped by her stepfather and wanted to get an abortion and broke federal law to do so. I mean, I call him the happy mullah. I mean, he's just kind of like smiling and talks about these wonderful, wonderful kind of economic populism issues. But he's quite extreme.
I'm not sure the fair tax is going to go over very well. I mean, I think people would like the idea of not, April 15th being just another day. You don't have to file an income tax return anymore. But I think that the when you start talking about the levels that the tax would have to reach to duplicate the revenue we get now, he's going to have a very tough sell to make. You know, I also don't think he's been campaigning much in Iowa, and you would think a guy like him, that's Iowa's kind of tailor-made for a guy with no money who can put a lot of time into one state, and as far as I've seen, he hasn't been.
Fred Thompson, former senator, TV actor, and 2008 Republican, picked up what might have been an important endorsement from the National Right to Life Committee this week. Here's Executive Director David Osteen explaining why the committee's backing him.
He is best positioned to top pro-abortion candidate Rudy Giuliani for the Republican nomination, and also looking at polls against likely Democrats, he is well positioned and we believe best positioned to win the presidency of the United States for unborn children.
I say it might have been an important endorsement because I'm wondering if David Osteen is one of the few people in America who actually believe that Fred Thompson is best positioned to win the presidency of the United States. Steve Chapman.
I would think, yeah, he's probably one of the few. It was kind of a surprising endorsement because Thompson did do some lobbying for an abortion rights group while he was in the private sector as a lawyer. You have other candidates like John McCain who have long and pretty solid pro-life voting records, and probably it looks like at this point a better chance of winning the nomination than Thompson.
Rick Perlstein on Fred Thompson.
Well, I mean, when you get to the issue of endorsements and you get to the issue of religious leaders making the endorsements, I mean, we talk about them as religious leaders and we don't want to speak ill of them because they're men of the cloth, but they're also political leaders and often they act like political bosses. So if he gets his hands on a candidate that he kind of has for his own, that gives him a lot of power within the campaign. I mean, someone like Dobson, who came very hard against Rudy Giuliani, that seems to have very much to do with the fact that Rudy Giuliani refused to kiss his ring. I mean, we're talking about very tough kind of machine-style politics here in addition to social conservatism.
Jack Beatty, you want to weigh in on Fred Thompson?
Well, you know, there is a feeling that he's just kind of staggering around out there, that he is not that this isn't something he has his heart in. And I don't know why he's done it. But he's when he announced in New Hampshire, his numbers went up and they have just come down 8 points, 10 points, just steadily down. For one thing, he hasn't made many visits up here. And when he does, he's just not impressive. People come away and they say, what was all that excitement about? This guy seems to be asleep.
I want to ask a question about Mitt Romney, former Massachusetts governor, one of the GOP frontrunners in 2008. The quote-unquote revelation out of the Romney camp this week that his handlers don't want him to address the Mormon issue, even though he wants to talk about how being a Mormon and possibly a president might eventually affect his presidency, should he make it to the White House. And I'm wondering if you think he'll eventually make the Mormon version of the Catholic John F. Kennedy, the Vatican will not rule the White House speech, at some point down the line. Jack?
Well, you know, I don't know why he hasn't done it earlier. I don't know whether it helped Kennedy or not, but it certainly was a major statement that his campaign could cite. And the polls keep showing there is a kind of resistance, especially in the South, to the idea of a Mormon candidate. And a speech wouldn't clear the air of that, but it would at least address it. And he could perhaps say, you know, I'm running for president of the United States, not my church, or make all those distinctions. I don't see how it could hurt him.
Rick Perlstein?
It's interesting. I kind of see from a Machiavellian perspective. I didn't know about that. I didn't hear about the idea that his aides wanted him to do one thing, but he claims to do another. But it seems to me that people worry about Mitt Romney as being this completely programmed guy who's just a product of his consultants. So if they can manufacture this kind of internecine struggle in which he's, you know, pushing aside his consultants and being his own man, that seems to be strategically useful for him.
Steve Chapman,
can I be cynical?
Steve Chapman, if Romney makes the speech, does he wait until after the primaries are over with, if he wins and becomes the presumptive nominee, or does he make it before the primary season's over?
Well, I think the problem may be bigger in the Republican primary, so he may have to address it before, you know, the South Carolina primary. I would think he may have to address it more than once, but I think he's kind of got to do it before the primaries are over.
Although,
excuse me.
No, go ahead, Jack.
No, you go ahead, Bob. I was just going to shift the ground a little.
Although he's doing pretty well in the polls in the individual states, in the individual early states.
He is. And is coming up in the national polls as well. You know, there was to me, the Romney story this week was the big profile in the New York Times about his year in France in the late 60s as a missionary for the Mormon Church, which young men do, part of their coming of age in that church. And it brought out that he was strongly for the Vietnam War, in favor of it, but wasn't serving in it. And you know, he had a religious exemption, and then he had a student exemption. Well, now, of course, he's strongly for the Iraq War, and he has five sons, but they're not serving in it.
We're talking about the week in news this hour. Here are some of the other stories making headlines this week. In drought-stricken Georgia, the governor prays for rain.
God, we need you. We need rain.
And it did rain. An answered prayer or good timing. In California, the cleanup continues on the coast after a major oil spill.
There's brown on the bird, which it looks natural, but then obviously it couldn't move its wings, and it was just walking on the sand trying to get into the water.
And the Broadway cliffhanger, will the stagehand strike mean curtains for the holiday theater season?
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch. You really are a heel.
With us on the roundtable this morning, Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial page writer at the Chicago Tribune, Rick Perlstein, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, where he writes the blog The Big Con, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. The big international news this morning is occurring pretty much right now in Pakistan. John Negroponte, the senior U.S. envoy, has arrived in Pakistan, hoping to persuade President Pervez Musharraf to end the emergency rule that's erupted into a major political crisis. Just hours before his arrival, opposition leader, former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, was released from house arrest for a second time and instantly renewed her criticism of Musharraf, saying emergency decree and the detention of moderates has only emboldened Islamic militants instead of aiding the fight against extremism, as Musharraf claims. Here she is promising to continue to speak out in Pakistan.
No matter how many of us they lock up, there will be still others to protest a tyranny that is destroying Pakistan, that has conceded our tribal lands to elements who no longer fly the flag of Pakistan.
Here's first question to our guest analyst, Steve Chapman. Will Bhutto rest until Musharraf is out?
Not necessarily. When she came back, it looked like there was sort of an agreement that she and Musharraf were going to find a way to share power and ease the transition to civilian rule.
But the tensions ratcheted up in that time, and I'm wondering if that equation, if it were true to begin with, still holds.
Well, I don't know. I think there's still some possibility that they'll work something out, and that she'll find a way to for the general to save face. It's just kind of a sad story that the savior of Pakistan is Benazir Bhutto, who was a failure as prime minister, whose husband is famously corrupt. I think she probably is the best hope for Pakistan, but that's a pretty sad commentary.
Yeah, it just shows that America in this whole thing seems almost impotent. I mean, it reminds me of a story from the spring of 2001 when Macedonia was on its way to civil war, and suddenly the clouds cleared and everything worked out. And a reporter asked one of the principals, "What happened? Why were you able to resolve this?" And he said, "Well, it was Colin Powell's fax machine. Colin Powell was able to send a fax saying, 'We don't like the way this is going. Resolve your differences peacefully.'" And at that point, America had the kind of moral power, the kind of soft power, the kind of suasion to get the world to do our bidding without the force of arms. That's the kind of power, soft power, that the Bush administration has squandered with its failed foreign policy.
Jack Beatty, what's Negroponte likely to accomplish or not?
Well, you know, I don't know. I just think that, I mean, there was a piece in the Times the other day that hinted that we're shopping around for somebody else. Now, whether that means we're talking to the military about displacing General Musharraf, I don't know. But we're the umbilical for the military there. We sustain them. They have business interests and so on. And if they see that their future should be more with what we want to do, and that Musharraf is a hindrance in what they want to do, I would you could even look for a kind of a quiet, or maybe not so quiet, coup with the U.S. involved on the side of getting rid of Musharraf.
Here's White House Press Secretary Dana Perino saying that General Musharraf needs to end emergency rules so that parliamentary elections can take place.
We don't see how it is possible to have free and fair elections under emergency rule. You want to have emergency rule lifted so that people could protest peacefully, or that they could campaign, and so that a free media can cover the election as we do here.
Predictions. Will there be elections in January in Pakistan, which Musharraf is suggesting right now, or not? Or when will there be elections there? Rick Perlstein?
I can't say. I can't predict. All I know is that when someone like Dana Perino says something like that, it's very hard for the rest of the world to take it seriously, because the rest of the world does not look at America as an honest broker and respectfully.
Steve Chapman.
We, I think we could force elections in Pakistan if we wanted to. I think the problem for the Bush administration is we don't really know what the best option is in this case, whether we need to stick with Musharraf at all costs as the only guy who can keep the country under control and fight the insurgency, or whether we need to move toward a civilian government that might be able to defuse some of the radicalism. I think if the Bush administration knew for sure what sort of situation this is, whether we're dealing with the Shah of Iran or Ferdinand Marcos, then it would be a lot easier.
Jack Beatty, do you think, since you raised the question, do you think Musharraf can hang on? Do you think that the Bush White House would be comfortable with a Bhutto government should she return to power?
I'm sure it would have its downside for them. But, you know, our focus has been al-Qaeda there. And, of course, General Musharraf has really played President Bush on that. He's cut his deals with the tribes that are protecting al-Qaeda. There's been a kind of desultory military campaign against them. He released a bunch of political prisoners, supposedly al-Qaeda or Taliban, in exchange for ransoming, for getting back some of his own troops. In short, he's played that card with us without doing much to honor his side of the bargain. As far as I can see, that's just been another one of the failures of Bush foreign policy. He just trusted this man, and somnambulistically we've gone on thinking he's doing something. He hasn't done anything.
The war funding bill and the war in Iraq. The Senate votes today on the House-passed $50 billion funding bill for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But because it sets a goal of having combat forces out of Iraq by December of next year, it's not expected to get the 60 votes needed to move forward in the Senate, which possibly means the Pentagon won't have the money it needs to wage the wars. Defense Secretary Robert Gates threatening hundreds of thousands of layoffs, but Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid dismissed is that, saying lawmakers just approved a massive military spending bill. Arizona Senator John Kyle says war funding should not have any strings attached.
We should never condition the funding for the troops in the field on some withdrawal date insisted upon, an arbitrary withdrawal date insisted upon by the Democratic leaders.
Who's to be believed here? Do you think the administration would actually go forward and begin Pentagon-related layoffs? Sally is calling from Newbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment on this, and I was wondering if your guests could address this issue. Also, the reports that the actual costs of the war are at least double what the administration is saying they are, and the fact that we're expected to pony up billions more when here at home, so much of our daily lives are underfunded, education, infrastructure, all of this. And also that, you know, I heard this morning that the Bush administration and the Pentagon are threatening to close bases across the country. It just seems like another Republican tactic to threaten the Democrats. And I just was wondering if your guests could address some of these issues.
Let's get Steve Chapman to weigh in first, Steve.
Oh, I think the Bush administration would probably love the opportunity to start laying off people at military bases and blame the Democrats. So I think probably the Democrats will find a way to climb down from this at some point.
Although, if the Democrats are smart, they'll probably be able to catch Bush in a lie on this stuff. I mean, they did before. The last time he said they were going to have to, you know, cut troops funding for troops in the field, the money he was talking about had already been appropriated. I mean, he's not an honest broker in these questions either.
You know, and this is yet another exercise in futility. Someone held up a card the other day. It's 41-0. 41 different times in different ways the Democrats have tried to limit funding on Iraq or put in timetables for truth and for troops to come home, and 41 times they have been turned back. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
the time to do it was in January of 2003.
Let me add one other point, by the way. Bob, you said isn't going to be able to get the 60 votes to pass, which basically means the Republicans are filibustering to keep the war going. And that's not the language that people are using in the press, which is quite unfortunate. I mentioned at the beginning that the Republicans are on track to basically filibuster three times as much legislation as any previous Congress. And what we're talking about is obstruction of a clear mandate from the American people to begin to get out of Iraq.
They may not get the 60 votes, but Majority Leader, Democratic Senator Harry Reid, says he's ready to continue waging the battle over this war funding bill.
This bill has $50 billion in it, yet the president is not willing to take that with some conditions on it, then the president won't get his $50 billion. That's pretty clear.
Who's winning the PR battle in the fight over funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? The PR battle for the lack of a better phrase, hearts and minds of the American people, the administration or the House and the Senate Democrats, or neither? Jack Beatty?
Neither. I mean, Frank Rich used a verb last week that got my attention in the New York Times. He said the public despises this Democratic Congress and the president. Now, that's a tough verb, but I think there is just a rage among Democrats at the fecklessness of this Congress, not just in the war. They can argue, you know, I mean, what can we do against the filibuster and so on, but across the board, that they simply haven't been living up to their promises. And of course, the administration, I mean, Bush now, I think, is the least popular president ever, at least for the longest time, according to one poll I've seen.
Also on Capitol Hill this week, the new U.S. Attorney General Michael Mukasey was sworn into office, taking over a Justice Department in turmoil. During the swearing-in ceremony, here's what President Bush had to say about Mukasey's role in the war on terror.
He knows what it takes to fight the war on terror effectively, and he knows how to do it in a manner that is consistent with our laws and our Constitution.
But is it the war, the turmoil inside the Justice Department? That's Mukasey's first and biggest challenge at the Justice Department right now. Steve Chapman?
Yeah, I think it is, and I don't think I don't think there was ever any chance we were going to get an attorney general who would say torture is always illegal. I think they did get an attorney general who's not going to tolerate firing U.S. attorneys for petty political reasons. You know, Mukasey is not – he's a man with a pretty distinguished record as a judge, and I don't think he wants the first line in his obituary to be that he preserved the policies of Alberto Gonzalez.
Externally, Mukasey may soon be asked to make decisions soon on a number of critical controversial issues. For example, the use of waterboarding as a prisoner interrogation technique, the issue that almost derailed his nomination over his unwillingness to talk about it during Senate confirmation hearings. If he gives the White House a legal opinion on waterboarding, care to venture a guess on which way he'll come down, Rick Perlstein?
Well, he'll say it's not torture, because if he says it's torture, President Bush goes to jail.
Jack Beatty.
I think that will be a good answer. You know, recently a man named Malcolm Nance, a veteran special operations consultant to the Navy, who's undergone waterboarding, gave testimony about it to the Congress, and this is what he said: unless you have been strapped down to the board, have endured the agonizing feeling of the water overpowering your gag reflex, and then feel your throat open and allowing pint after pint of water to involuntarily fill your lungs, you will not know the meaning of the word torture.
Let's talk now about Barry Bonds, the home run king, passed Hank Aaron this season, then left San Francisco or left the team, now finds himself in legal hot water. Here's what his attorney, Mike Raines, had to say in terms of his hopes that Barry Bonds' reputation will be repaired when he's found innocent if he goes to trial.
What we will keep asking is whether the media and whether the government of this country will spend as much time repairing Barry's reputation as it has spent destroying him after he is proven innocent by a fair and impartial jury.
There are some people who say that they were surprised that after all the controversy all season long about whether Barry Bonds used steroids or not and whether he lied about using steroids or not, that he now faces legal trouble. Steve Chapman, you surprised?
That he was indicted? No, I wasn't surprised. And I, as far as what his lawyer had to say, I think there's a reasonably good chance he'll be found not guilty.
Why do you say that?
Well, you know, he's going to have the best lawyer's money can buy.
Got to prove intent.
You've got to prove that he knew what he was taking and so on and so forth. And nobody has testified to seeing Bonds actually using steroids, which is different from the case with some other people, like Marion Jones. And I think, you know, he may win in court, that's not going to be the same as rehabilitating his reputation or proving that he's innocent.
Jack Beatty.
Yeah, and his attorney was mentioning a racial motivation in this, which seems to me an ugly charge and wholly unjustified.
And Steve Chapman? I mean, Rick Perlstein?
Well, a lot of Americans will be saying, how does his hat size expand if he's just taken aspirin?
Finally, I can't avoid the water story. The drought ravaging the southeastern U.S., certainly on the lips of most people there, because of rationing, some people can only turn on their taps to moisten their parched lips for just a few hours a day. This crisis for some, which for most of us we just take for granted, having access to drink, cook, bathe, flush, is taking a political turn with some conservatives saying, don't look for a bailout. Your local water systems, your local sewer systems are your local problem. Does this have the makings of a political football or a big fat water balloon? Rick Perlstein?
I'd like to respond to that. That's perfectly absurd. You know, a river does not honor the boundary of a state or a municipality. We're talking about the Chattahoochee River here. This is clearly a federal issue. This is clearly an issue of collective responsibility, and it's clearly a failure of conservative governance if they're going to blame individual municipalities for a regional drought. It's actually pretty disgusting that they would say that.
Rick Perlstein gets the last word. Rick Perlstein, senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Steve Chapman, columnist and editorial page editor at the Chicago Tribune. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst who's always on point, thanks to the three of you. On Point host Tom Ashbrook is recuperating from a successful bypass surgery earlier this week. Tom's doctor says the procedure went well. He'll be back in the host chair on January 2nd. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. Happy with that news. This is On Point.